Chapter 3. Narrative. At that famous period of history, when the 17th century, after a deal of quarreling, king killing, reforming, republicanizing, restoring, re-restoring, playwriting, sermon writing, Oliver Cromwellizing, Stuartizing, and Durandizing, to be sure, had sunk into its grave, giving place to the lusty 18th. When Mr. Isaac Newton was a tutor of Trinity, and Mr. Joseph Addison Commissioner of Appeals, when the presiding genius that watched over the destinies of the French nation had played out all the best cards in his hand, and his adversaries began to pour in their trumps, when there were two kings in Spain employed perpetually in running away from one another, when there was a queen in England, with such rogues for ministers as have never been seen, no, not in our own day, and a general, of whom it may be severely argued, whether he was the meanest miser, or the greatest hero in the world, when Mrs. Masham had not yet put Madame Marlborough's nose out of joint, when people had their ears cut off for writing very meek political pamphlets, and very large full-bottomed wigs were just beginning to be worn with powder, and the face of Louis the Great, as his was handed in to him behind the bed curtains, was, when issuing thence, observed to look longer, older, and more dismal daily. About the year 1705, that is, in the glorious reign of Queen Anne, there existed certain characters, and befell a series of adventures, which, since they are strictly in accordance with the present fashionable style and taste, since they have been already partly described in the Newgate Calendar, since they are, as shall be seen anon, agreeably low, delightfully disgusting, and at the same time eminently pleasing and pathetic, may properly be set down here. And though it may be said, with some considerable show of reason, that agreeably low and delightfully disgusting characters have already been treated, both copiously and ably, by some eminent writers of the present and, indeed, of future ages, though to tread in the footsteps of the immortal Fagin requires a genius of inordinate stride, and to go a robbing after the late though deathless Turpin, the renowned Jack Sheppard, or the embryo Duval, may be impossible, and not an infringement, but a wasteful indication of ill will towards the Eighth Commandment, though it may, on the one hand, be asserted that only vain coxcombs would dare to write on subjects already described by men really and deservedly eminent, on the other hand, that these subjects have been described so fully that nothing more can be said about them, on the third hand, allowing, for the sake of argument, three hands to one figure of speech, that the public has heard so much of them as to be quite tired of rogues, thieves, cutthroats, and Newgate altogether. Though all these objections may be urged, and each is excellent, yet we intend to take a few more pages from the L.D. Bailey Calendar, to bless the public with one more draft from the Stone Jug * yet a while to listen, hurdle mounted, and riding down the Oxford Road, to the bland conversation of Jack Ketch, and to hang with him round the neck of his patient, at the end of our and his history. We give the reader fair notice, that we shall tickle him with a few such scenes of villainy, throat-cutting, and bodily suffering in general, as are not to be found, no, not in, never mind comparisons, for such are odious. *This, as your ladyship is aware, is the polite name for Her Majesty's prison of Newgate. In the year 1705 then, whether it was that the Queen of England did feel seriously alarmed at the notion that a French prince should occupy the Spanish throne, or whether she was tenderly attached to the Emperor of Germany, or whether she was obliged to fight out the quarrel of William of Orange, who made us pay and fight for his Dutch provinces, or whether poor old Louis Quatres did really frighten her, or whether Sarah Jennings and her husband wanted to make a fight, knowing how much they should gain by it. Whatever the reason was, it was evident that the war was to continue, and there was almost as much soldiering and recruiting, parading, pike and gun exercising, flag flying, drum beating, powder blazing, and military enthusiasm, as we can all remember in the year 1801, what time the Corsican upstart menaced our shores. A recruiting party and captain of Cutt's regiment, which had been so mangled at Blenheim the year before, were now in Warwickshire, and having their depot at Warwick, the captain and his attendant, the corporal, were used to travel through the country, seeking for heroes to fill up the gaps in Cutt's corps, and for adventures to pass away the weary time of a country life. Our Captain Plume and Sergeant Kite, it was at this time, by the way, that those famous recruiting officers were playing their pranks in Shrewsbury, were occupied very much in the same manner with Farquhar's heroes. They roamed from Warwick to Stratford, and from Stratford to Birmingham, persuading the swains of Warwickshire to leave the plough for the pike, and dispatching, from time to time, small detachments of recruits to extend Marlborough's lines, and to act as food for the hungry cannon at Ramillies and Malplaquet. Of those two gentlemen who are about to act a very important part in our history, one only was probably a native of Britain. We say probably, because the individual in question was himself quite uncertain, and, it must be added, entirely indifferent about his birthplace. But speaking the English language, and having been during the course of his life pretty generally engaged in the British service, he had a tolerably fair claim to the majestic title of Briton. His name was Peter Brock, otherwise Corporal Brock, of Lord Cutt's Regiment of Dragoons. He was of age about 57, even that point has never been ascertained, in height about 5 feet 6 inches, in weight, nearly 13 stone. With a chest that the celebrated leech himself might envy, an arm that was like an opera dancer's leg, a stomach so elastic that it would accommodate itself to any given or stolen quantity of food, a great aptitude for strong liquors, a considerable skill in singing chansons to table of not the most delicate kind. He was a lover of jokes, of which he made many, and passably bad. When pleased, simply coarse, boisterous, and jovial, when angry, a perfect demon. Bullying, cursing, storming, fighting, as is sometimes the wont with gentlemen of his cloth and education. Mr. Brock was strictly what the Marquis of Roddle styled himself in a proclamation to his soldiers after running away, a hijo de la guerra, a child of war. Not seven cities, but one or two regiments, might contend for the honor of giving him birth. For his mother, whose name he took, had acted as camp follower to a royalist regiment, had then obeyed the parliamentarians, died in Scotland when Monk was commanding in that country, and the first appearance of Mr. Brock in a public capacity displayed him as a fifer in the general's own regiment of Coldstreamers, when they marched from Scotland to London, and from a republic at once into a monarchy. Since that period, Brock had been always with the army. He had had, too, some promotion, for he spake of having a command at the Battle of the Boyne, though probably, as he never mentioned the fact, upon the losing side. The very year before this narrative commences, he had been one of Mordaunt's forlorn hope at Schellenberg, for which service he was promised a pair of colors. He lost them, however, and was almost shot, but fate did not ordain that his career should close in that way, for drunkenness and insubordination immediately after the battle, but having in some measure reinstated himself by a display of much gallantry at Blenheim, it was found advisable to send him to England for the purposes of recruiting, and remove him altogether from the regiment, where his gallantry only rendered the example of his riot more dangerous. Mr. Brock's commander was a slim young gentleman of 26, about whom there was likewise a history, if one would take the trouble to inquire. He was a Bavarian by birth, his mother being an English lady, and enjoyed along with a dozen other brothers the title of Count. 11 of these, of course, were penniless. One or two were priests, one a monk, 6 or 7 in various military services, and the elder at home at Schloss Galgenstein breeding horses, hunting wild boars, swindling tenants, living in a great house with small means, obliged to be sorted at home all the year, to be splendid for a month at the capital, as is the way with many other noblemen. Our young count, Count Gustavus Adolphus Maximilian von Gelgenstein, had been in the service of the French as page to a nobleman, then of His Majesty's Guards du Corps, then a lieutenant and captain in the Bavarian service, and when, after the Battle of Blenheim, two regiments of Germans came over to the winning side, Gustavus Adolphus Maximilian found himself among them, and at the epoch when this story commences, had enjoyed English pay for a year more. It is unnecessary to say how he exchanged into his present regiment, how it appeared that, before her marriage, handsome John Churchill had known the young gentleman's mother, when they were both penniless hangers-on at Charles II's court. It is, we say, quite useless to repeat all the scandal, of which we are perfectly masters, and to trace step by step the events of his history. Here, however, was Gustavus Adolphus, in a small inn, in a small village of Warwickshire, on an autumn evening in the year 1705, and at the very moment when this history begins, he and Mr. Brock, his corporal and friend, were seated at a round table before the kitchen fire, while a small groom of the establishment was leading up and down on the village green, before the inn door, two black, glossy, long-tailed, barrel-bellied, thick-flanked, arch-necked, Roman-nosed Flanders horses, which were the property of the two gentlemen now taking their ease at the Oogle Inn. The two gentlemen were seated at their ease at the inn table, drinking mountain wine. And if the reader fancies from the sketch which we have given of their lives, or from his own blindness and belief in the perfectibility of human nature, that the sun of that autumn evening shone upon any two men in county or city, at desk or harvest, at court or at Newgate, drunk or sober, who were greater rascals than Count Gustavus Galgenstein and Corporal Peter Brock, he is egregiously mistaken, and his knowledge of human nature is not worth a fig. If they had not been two prominent scoundrels, what earthly business should we have in detailing their histories? What would the public care for them? Who would meddle with dull virtue, humdrum sentiment, or stupid innocence, when vice, agreeable vice, is the only thing which the readers of romances care to hear? The little horse boy, who was leading the two black Flanders horses up and down the green, might have put them in the stable for any good that the horses got by the gentle exercise which they were now taking in the cool evening air, as their owners had not ridden very far or very hard, and there was not a hair turned of their sleek shining coats. But the lad had been especially ordered so, to walk the horses about until he received further commands from the gentleman reposing in the Oogle kitchen, and the idlers of the village seemed so pleased with the beasts, and their smart saddles and shining bridles, that it would have been a pity to deprive them of the pleasure of contemplating such an innocent spectacle. Over the count's horse was thrown a fine red cloth, richly embroidered in yellow worsted, a very large count's coronet and a ciffer at the four corners of the covering, and under this might be seen a pair of gorgeous silver stirrups, and above it, a couple of silver-mounted pistols reposing in bearskin holsters. The bit was silver too, and the horse's head was decorated with many smart ribbons. Of the corporal's steed, suffice it to say, that the ornaments were in brass, as bright, though not perhaps so valuable, as those which decorated the captain's animal. The boys, who had been at play on the green, first paused and entered into conversation with the horse boy, then the village matrons followed, and afterwards, sauntering by ones and twos, came the village maidens, who loved soldiers as flies love treacle. Presently the mails began to arrive, and lo, the parson of the parish, taking his evening walk with Mrs. Dobbs, and the four children his offspring, at length joined himself to his flock. To this audience the little ostler explained that the animals belonged to two gentlemen now reposing at the Oogle, one young with gold hair, the other old with grizzled locks, both in red coats, both in jack boots, putting the house into a bustle, and calling for the best. He then discoursed to some of his own companions regarding the merits of the horses, and the parson, a learned man, explained to the villagers that one of the travelers must be a count, or at least, had a count's horse cloth, pronounced that the stirrups were of real silver, and checked the impetuosity of his son, William Nassau Dobbs, who was for mounting the animals, and who expressed a longing to fire off one of the pistols in the holsters. As this family discussion was taking place, the gentleman whose appearance had created so much attention came to the door of the inn, and the elder and stouter was seen to smile at his companion, after which he strolled leisurely over the green, and seemed to examine with much benevolent satisfaction the assemblage of villagers who were staring at him and the quadrupeds. Mr. Brock, when he saw the parson's band and cassock, took off his beaver reverently, and saluted the divine. "Hope your reverence won't bolt the little fellow," said he. "I think I heard him calling out for a ride, and whether he should like my horse, or his lordship's horse, I am sure it is all one." "Don't be afraid, sir, the horses are not tired. We have only come 70 miles today, and Prince Eugene once rode a matter of 52 leagues, 150 miles, sir, upon that horse, between sunrise and sunset." "Gracious powers, on which horse?" said Dr. Dobbs, very solemnly. "On this, sir, on mine, Corporal Brock of Cutts Black Gelding, William of Nassau. The prince, sir, gave it me after Blenheim fight, for I had my own legs carried away by a cannonball, just as I cut down two of Sauerkrauter's regiment, who had made the prince prisoner." "Your own legs, sir?" said the doctor. "Gracious goodness! This is more and more astonishing." "No, no, not my own legs, my horses I mean, sir, and the prince gave me William of Nassau that very day." To this no direct reply was made, but the doctor looked at Mrs. Dobbs, and Mrs. Dobbs and the rest of the children at her eldest son, who grinned and said, "Isn't it wonderful?" The corporal to this answered nothing, but, resuming his account, pointed to the other horse and said, "That horse, sir, good as mine is that horse, with the silver stirrups, is His Excellency's horse, Captain Count Maximilian Gustavus Adolphus von Galgenstein, Captain of Horse, and of the Holy Roman Empire." He lifted here his hat with much gravity, and all the crowd, even to the parson, did likewise. "He call him George of Denmark, sir, in compliment to Her Majesty's husband. He is Blenheim too, sir. Marshal Tallard rode him on that day, and you know how he was taken prisoner by the Count." "George of Denmark, Marshal Tallard, William of Nassau. This is strange indeed, most wonderful. Why, sir, little are you aware that there are before you, at this moment, two other living beings who bear these venerated names. My boys, stand forward. Look here, sir. These children have been respectively named after our late sovereign, and the husband of our present queen. And very good names too, sir. And very noble little fellows too, and I propose that, with your reverence and your ladyship's leave, William Nassau here shall ride on George of Denmark, and George of Denmark shall ride on William of Nassau." When this speech of the corporal's was made, the whole crowd set up a loyal hurrah, and, with much gravity, the two little boys were lifted up into the saddles, and the corporal leading one, entrusted the other to the horse boy, and so together marched stately up and down the green. The popularity which Mr. Brock gained by this maneuver was very great, but with regard to the names of the horses and children, which coincided so extraordinarily, it is but fair to state that the christening of the quadrupeds had only taken place about 2 minutes before the dragoon's appearance on the green. For if the fact must be confessed, he, while seated near the inn window, had kept a pretty wistful eye upon all going on without, and the horses marching thus to and fro for the wonderment of the village were only placards or advertisements for the riders. There was, besides the boy now occupied with the horses, and the landlord and landlady of the Eagle Inn, another person connected with that establishment, a very smart, handsome, vain, giggling servant girl, about the age of 16, who went by the familiar name of Cat, and attended upon the gentleman in the parlor, while Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.